Gerald missing someone in the first 3 years cycle of the project, and I am thrilled that you're able to be back. Manuel Vasquez is a professor of religion and Latin American Latino studies at the University of Florida in Gainesville. University of Florida now has a PhD program in religion, so spread the word. It's a terrific program, if only for the opportunity to work with Manuel. His first book was a terrific book. It's called The Brazilian Popular Church and the Crisis of Modernity. We read that for one of our groups years ago that was published by Cambridge University Press and received the 1998 award from the American Academy of Religion. His most recent publications include Latin American Religions, Histories and Documents, and Globalizing the Sacred Religion Across the Americas, and a co-edited volume entitled Immigrant Faiths, Transforming Religion in America. Some of you have probably heard Manuel recently on Speaking of Faith with Krista Tippett, and then on the wonderful show, the Bill Moyer Show. You looked wonderful on that set. And all that's available online. That was just about a month ago. And I should be your agent. I'd be doing okay these days if I were your agent. So welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks very much for the invitation. I hesitated when you gave me the first invitation because I said, well, you know, I'm not a theologian. I don't have the sophisticated language of ecclesiology and what is it, sacramentality and all these things that I'm not quite sure what to make of. And so I was inclined when you contacted me to say, I'm sorry, I cannot make it because I'm not sure that I would be able to contribute anything to the conversation. But I remember the wonderful conversations that we've had here, right? And I said, oh, and the food and the wine, I said, oh, I better go. So, and I said, so, but what can I contribute to this conversation, the language of peace? I'm not working on this idea of the language of peace. And the more I thought, the more I realized that the discourse that I was confronting as I studied the issue of immigration was in many ways the antithesis of the language of peace. And so I wanted to use this opportunity to reflect on how is it that we have gotten to where we are in this discussion in ways that we're not framing the issue through the language of peace. So that's where I want to go. Now, granted that the issue of immigration is a complex one that has a myriad of global as well as national and local consequences, one that touches multiple realms of life, including economic, politics, law, religion, and the environment. It's a personally felt issue. In some of the emails I got, you saw the reading is there. In some of the emails I got, there were some desperate voices that were saying, you know, immigrants have moved into my neighborhood, the prices of my house, what am I going to do, you know? And so it was a personal thing for them that they had these people who were different from them, and what do we do about my neighborhood? I'm fearing that my neighborhood is gonna go down. And so these are real fears that I think are very much passionate. And I wanted to really take that into account as we talk about this issue, because this is an issue that's complex. Nevertheless, I can't say that I have not been shocked at the heat generated by the issue this past year. I think the nadir for me came when Rudy Giuliani and Mitt Romney vehemently accused each other of running, quote, a sanctuary city and a sanctuary mansion. I mean, sanctuary as a biblical, I think you guys know about that, biblical and church historians know well, has a long and rich tradition in Christianity and Judaism, a tradition of welcoming the stranger, taking care of him or her as one of our, you know, the most vulnerable in our society. The New Sanctuary Movement, the activists of the New Sanctuary Movement often quote Leviticus 19:33, quote, when a stranger sojourns with you in your land, you shall not do him wrong. He shall be as native among you, and you shall love him as yourself, for you were yourself strangers in the land of Egypt. Jim Wallace goes as far as constructing this as what he calls the Levitical immigration policy. Even without going that far, I think when the word sanctuary becomes a dirty word, a term to disqualify the other for moral torpitude, something really wrong is going on. And so this sense of unease for me was only magnified by the blog responses I received after my interview with Bill Moyers, which is what appears in your reading. Now, to tell you the truth, when I came out of the interview, I was saying, gosh, I should have been a little more radical. I should have been a little more radical. I should have, like, really stood there and have been unequivocal and say, you know, look, this is the wrong way of framing the issue, and we need to move on beyond that. But I felt that I was too soft. I was too moderate, not being provocative enough, you know. And I felt that it was more constructive to raise questions than to state forcefully a pro-immigrant position. I simply wanted us Americans to think about the complexities, the ambivalences, and the predicaments behind the issue of immigration, beyond polarizing terms like illegal and amnesty. But as you can see from the printout, and included in the readings, while some of the responses were thoughtful, many of the reactions were dismissive and angry, sincerely. And so for a while, for the 2 days, I don't know how I felt. I guess it was more disappointment that my adopted country would take that kind of, you know, citizens that, you know, in a country that I have chosen to live would do this kind of thing to a fellow citizen, right? And so I was kind of like, not angry, but more in despair. What do we do about this? That was one aspect that I needed to consider. Then I've been also directing, co-directing a project called Religion and the Politics of Encounter, which is looking at immigrants in new destinations. Because post-1965, there have been changes in immigration. Immigration is no longer a dynamic that we see in the so-called gateway cities, like Miami, Houston, Los Angeles, New York. But now immigration is a national issue. It's an issue that affects Iowa. It's an issue that affects Georgia. North Carolina has the highest, Latino growth of the states in the union. And so it's an issue that now affects the entire union, right? And so the question then is, what happens when you have immigrants who are coming into places that are not used to having immigration? What happens when difference emerges in the midst of places that have not had this kind of difference asserted in the midst? And so that's the kind of project that I'm working on. And we're focusing on Atlanta as a kind of crucible where these things are taking place. And we're focusing particularly on how churches mediate conflict and cross-cultural and interracial communication, but especially between Latinos and Natives. And we're especially interested between Latinos and African Americans. We're in the middle of the fieldwork phase of the project, but I'm already very concerned about the lack of knowledge that African Americans and Latinos have of each other, even though the two communities often live side by side and face some of the same social problems, such as poverty, high levels of school dropout, crime, all these problems that affect our communities. This lack of knowledge worries me because the two communities are coming to see each other through the simplistic frames that are used by the media. The media constantly portrays or set Latinos against African Americans as now the largest minority. So media frames uncritically rely on exclusionary notions of identity. This is what Eugene was talking about. The ontology of scarcity and competition, right? The idea is that identities are unitary, they're static, operating under a zero-sum logic. Each group is only interested in pursuing its own interest to the detriment of competing identities vying for scarce resources, right? This way of framing ethnic and interracial relations, it's not likely to facilitate a language of peace or to lead to what political scientist Robert Putnam has recently called a more capacious we. Now, if you know the work on social capital of Robert Putnam, he's concerned that pluralism creates division, balkanizes America. And he's trying to solve this problem. How do we create social capital that's not just bonding social capital within small communities so that each of us lives within our particular enclave, right? And we have intimate relations in those enclaves. But how do we have what he calls bridging capital that allows us to come out of our small cocoons and talk to each other in the diversity without reducing each other to the old assimilationist model, which has been the kind of core model that we've used, the melting pot. Now, if you think of the model of the melting pot is a totalizing model because it is a model that assumes that everyone is going to be boiled to one common stew. And you might have some flavors. You might have a little bit of pepper and jalapeno and all sorts of interesting flavors and curry and paprika, right? But overall, the main stock of the melting pot of the stew is the core Anglo-Saxon values that make possible for that stew to really have the firmness, right? It's the meat. And then immigrant groups come in and they might alter a little bit that, but they don't do it, right? Now, Putnam is basically trying to move beyond that, it seems to me, and I'm not sure if he succeeds, but he raises this issue of how can we become a more capacious we? And he gives a partial answer. He says, initially, when we have difference, we retrench to our communities, right? So when you have new destinations, you have immigrants who are coming in, they're different, they speak different languages, they cook different foods, they have different ways of understanding public spaces. Then the natives say, well, this is strange, I don't want them, right? And everyone retrenches, and there's no communication, right? And Putnam says, well, that's going to happen, and we need to work hard so that we can create, in the long run, a stronger democracy that's more pluralistic. But that's going to take work. So, getting back to that, the language, the kind of language that sets African Americans against Latinos in this kind of zero-sum game, the ontology of scarcity and competition, is not going to lead to a more capacious we that can embrace diversity without denying the specificities of individuals and group experiences, which is, I think, what Johnny was telling us about the theology of difference. Putnam sees this more inclusive we as key to the viability and strength of the democratic culture and civil society, because it moves beyond incommensurable differences. This we also holds in check the twin threats of rampant consumerist individualism and the tendency to retreat into enclaves of sameness. But it does so without subsuming us under a single worldview, which was the assimilationist perspective, that is often the reflection of dominant ideologies. This ever-enlarging, open-ended we is what allows us to talk about the common good. Right? Perhaps I'm being too charitable here with Putnam. Maybe I'm giving it too much of a radical reading, but I like to give a little bit of the hermeneutic, charitable hermeneutics to people that I talk to, which is part of the language of peace. Right? So I see deleterious influences in this discourse of exclusionary identity at the level of community leaders. I've been talking to African-American leaders and Latino leaders. And there is quite a bit of ambivalence toward Latinos among African-American leaders. On the one hand, many have told me that they see Latinos as the new face of the civil rights movement. These leaders were particularly impressed by the way the Latino community mobilized throughout the country in the massive demonstrations of April and May of 2006 to lobby for immigration reform. On the other hand, some African-American leaders are worried that Latinos don't really understand the devastating impact of slavery and racial segregation and the heroic struggles to end it. Because Latinos are too quick to buy into the ideology of the American dream, they fail to see that the opportunities and benefits they're pursuing and enjoying now were earned with the sweat and blood of the African-American community. And so in this sense, African-American leaders that I've talked to tell me is that Latinos have become sort of free riders rather than freedom riders. Conversely, many Latinos admire the charisma and moral core of African-American leaders, but there's still quite a bit of mistrust and even racism going around. And I think this, at least in part, explains Obama's difficulty with attracting Latinos. In all this, my main concern is that the ambivalence and mistrust may lead to violence, as it already has in some places like L.A. albeit sporadically. The possibility of inter-ethnic violence resulting from immigration is not so far-fetched. You might have read about the recent attacks against immigrants from Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Angola, by black South Africans in the township of Alexandra near Johannesburg. 42 people died, many of them burned alive, while many more were dragged out of their shacks and beaten by angry mobs. Apparently, the mobs are reported to have said, "Are you an immigrant? Where are you from? If you're an immigrant, come out, we'll bring you out," right? And so they were basically going out for immigrants. I am part of a research project based at the Social Science Research Council that is exploring the religious lives of immigrant minorities in three global cities, London, Kuala Lumpur, and Johannesburg. And it just so happened that our team was visiting Alexandra a couple of days before the violence started. And we could see the tension and despair in both the natives and the immigrants. I came out of the trip aware of the challenges that South Africa faces as it tries to build a truly non-racial democracy. And I'm not sure that they even know how to name it. Multiracial democracy, non-racial democracy, they don't know. Is it possible to have a non-racial democracy at all? We face, I think, some of the same challenges here in America. The poverty, the enduring segregation, the frustration, the anger in the minority communities. So given these experiences, the question that has gained importance for me is what leads us to engage each other in and through the language of peace? And conversely, and more importantly, what are the conditions that allow for the emergence of a discourse of civility and reciprocity around a potentially divisive topic? Now here, I'm going to give you my analysis. And like Charles, I went to school when postmodernism was all the rage. And so I am going to appeal to some of these thinkers. Now, I have a more benign view of postmodernism because I consider postmodernism useful for its deconstructive moment. That is, because it allows us, as Johnny was doing, to show the underside of modernity. It shows us what to reject of modernity, to render modernity more humble, right? Rather than this sweeping project that was supposed to be a global project of emancipation for humanity and endless progress, what postmodernism does is it lowers the ontological status of modernity. So modernity becomes fallible. And how do you make it fallible? Through a power analysis. And therefore, you have to bring back people like Foucault, even though de Grotti might not like it. Because what we need to do is we need to study forms of subjectivation and governmentality that are now oppressive, forms of what Foucault called biopower. And in that sense, I want to have a critique that goes beyond the critique of economics. I want a critique of how the power over life, over nature, over the body is exercised by our state, by our government, and by each other, on each other. And so, to me, the analytics of the microphysics of power that Foucault provides offers still the best roadmap to have this kind of thing. I would argue that what we have today, there was a whole discussion on globalization, what we have today is a globalization as a new regime of mobility. In other words, globalization by cultural theorists has tended to be theorized in terms of flows, right? Now, if you read Arjuna Paterai, famous theorist of globalization, it's all about flows. Flows here and flows there, and there are no borders. And the borders are permeable, and the identities are mutating, and everyone is hybrid, right? I would argue that, yes, there is mobility, widespread mobility. But I would argue that that mobility is part of a larger system of regulated control of bodies and populations. That it has to do with the economics that Eugene was talking about. It has to do with the fact that you can exploit a labor force that doesn't have any rights, right? A labor force that you don't pay the right wages. A labor force that has no political voice because they are illegal. And therefore, you can exploit them depending on the needs of the global market. That's what I call a regime of mobility, where surveillance, control, containment has been elevated, together with the idea of terrorism, right? The immigrant is the internal terrorist. It is the internal other that we want to control. And so we have two wars. We have two clashes of civilization. To quote Sam Huntington, the famous professor from Harvard, we have the clash of civilization with Islam, right, outside. That's the enemy outside. But we also have the clash of civilization with Hispanics inside, because they are bringing different kinds of cultural values that will, in the end, undermine the individualism and the pursuit of happiness that we, as Anglo-Saxons, I'm saying we, that Anglo-Saxons have, right? So, that's why I believe you cannot throw away postmodernism altogether. And I'm going to invoke some of this language, and I hope it's not too jarring. I hope it works, but I'm open to your suggestions. I think the single most important dynamic impeding communication through the language of peace is what anthropologist Johannes Fabian calls the denial of coevalness. Fabian uses this term to refer to one of the key strategies of colonialism, where the colonializer otherizes or creates an other in the native, in the colonialized native, constructing him or her as existing in a wholly different space and time than the metropole. That's why it's denial of coevalness. These people are different from us. They don't exist in the same time and space. This spatial-temporal distance that you create when you deny coevalness was conceived in evolutionary terms in anthropology. I'm a fellow traveler of anthropologists, and I always have a good time talking to them about all their sins. Of how their anthropological gaze was part of that otherizing, that denial of coevalness, because the anthropologist was going there to study someone else, the primitive, and maybe we learn about ourselves as we were 1,000 years ago, right? And so it's the origin of humanity. And it might be that we were savages before, or it might be that we were noble savages, right? And so you have this discourse in anthropology very much there. So it's conceived in evolutionary terms, with the colonized construed as primitive, thus exotic, naive, static, and simplistic, while the colonizer presents itself as not only civilized, but as civilizer, right? As having the divinely sanctioned task of teaching infantile natives to behave properly. France, in fact, had a clear idea of its destiny in the colonial enterprise. It had to advance what it's called mission civilisatrice, right? It was out there to civilize the world, and it was a manifest destiny. We have our own manifest destiny, right? In the context of the current debates on immigration, the distancing, the othering that I'm talking about, operates through the use of the discursive clusters built around the concept of illegality to refer to undocumented workers. In the post-9/11 climate, the discursive cluster of illegality ceases to be merely descriptive, and it takes on what Speech Act philosophers such as John Searle and J.L. Austin calls an illocutionary force. It has the power to create the reality that you describe. The illegal is we subjectivize the illegal as we name it. So we're creating a subject as we name it, right? Illegality constructs an enemy within, even the terrorist within. As I said with Samuel Huntington, thinking of the immigrant as this Trojan horse that's going to come and undermine our society. Illegality becomes synonymous with dark-skinned, hungry hordes of illiterate peasants wantonly violating our laws. The unauthorized immigrant as the criminal in our midst, who only deserves the law, not our compassion and solidarity. This is why I suggested in my response to the blog that the uncritical use of the term illegal is multiply dehumanizing. First, it objectifies the undocumented immigrant as a foreign other, the invader, not as a morally complex human being like all of us. They make tough choices when they come here. And, you know, they're not saints, but neither are they demons. Second, the unthinking use of the term illegal also dehumanizes the native-born because it makes them lose the capacity to feel the moral dilemmas and the often tragic predicaments behind much of the unauthorized immigration. Third, the use of the term illegal as an emotionally charged media soundbite not only obscures the complex causes and effects of undocumented immigration, but it does not allow U.S. citizens to engage each other as subjects who may disagree. So, if you say, wait a minute, we need to talk about this concept of illegality. No, we cannot talk about it. So even citizens silence each other with this term. We basically are forcing not just immigrants into non-being, but also citizens into non-being. Because the mere fact of stating that we need to have a rational, humane, and comprehensive discussion on the topic is seen as complicit with illegality, as unpatriotic, as naive, bleeding heart liberalism, right? What don't you get? You know, this is what people say. Why don't you get? I mean, an illegal is an illegal. Didn't they break our laws? If they break our laws, they need to be punished, right? And so this is what we're doing. What is it that you don't get? In this sense, the term illegality silences immigrants and native-born alike, which is the reason why Democrats like Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have been very reluctant to engage in a frank, intelligent conversation about immigration reform. Now, I commend Obama for engaging in a frank discussion about race, but immigration is not there. And it's part of the racial story, too, of America today, increasingly. The public square has become shaped by shrill voices, not by the language of peace. Moreover, I argue in my response to the blog that the term illegal abstracts U.S. citizens from the country's history, blinding us to the fact that in many cases our activities encouraged the process of undocumented immigration. Whether it was our government's counterinsurgency policies in Central America, or the implementation of trade agreements that do not lead to human development, but are only concerned with wealth accumulation, many of the undocumented immigrants who we have here, they have had to make hard choices to abandon their families and communities, pushed by structural dynamics not of their own making. And this is not just a matter of government. Our lifestyles and well-being are often supported by the invisible labor of undocumented immigrants. They clean our houses. They take care of our kids. They serve us dinner. They wash our plates. They pick the vegetables we eat. They prepare the meat we consume. Someone in the blog said, I'm going to go and I'm going to try not to hire, not to buy anything that is produced by these illegal immigrants. Every time you go to Taco Bell, every time you go to eat your burger at McDonald's, you're eating the labor of the immigrant. You're eating the sweat of probably an undocumented immigrant. So we're all complicit. We are ingesting. We have the illegal immigrant in ourselves. That's what I want to say. And I think the term illegality creates this distance that says they are lawbreakers. They're not like us. We are not lawbreakers. We have the moral high ground here. And therefore, what's the problem? Let's kick them out. Right? In saying this, I do not want to deny that national elites in Latin America or Asia or Africa do not play a major role in encouraging immigration. It is well known that many Latin American, African, and Asian governments are still characterized by widespread corruption and authoritarianism, that they are not responsive to the needs of their citizens. Nor do I want to imply that immigrants themselves don't have agency and responsibility. The reasons for immigration are multiple, from political and religious persecution to famine to the quest for personal independence and success. That's why I say we need to understand the immigrant as a complex person. There's no single immigrant that we can say, oh, okay, so the illegal immigrant is this, right? But you have people who have complex motivations and reasons for being here. And unless we meet these people as people, we are going to keep operating with these terms that really are not conducive to the language of peace. So it is precisely this complex interaction among structural and personal variables, among global, regional, national, and local processes that is obscured by the shorthand term illegal. The term illegal, once again, distances us, glossing over our moral responsibilities in this complex interaction as members of a global community. Okay, what can we learn from this debate, then, in our reflections of the language of peace? That the language of peace requires a recognition of the other as coeval. If denial of coevalness is the problem, then we need to recognize the other as coeval. That is, we have to meet the other as thou, not as an it, to talk about Buber, to use Buber's term. Or to meet him as infinity rather than totality, if you want to use Levinas language. That is, that we have to meet this other person in the irreducible fullness and contradictory nature of his multiple and her multiple identities. This encounter does not have to take place in the vacuum. That's the problem with Buber, that it's almost like a mystical experience that erupts, right? The I-thou cannot be sustained because it's so powerful and all-encompassing that we have to only have it sporadically, right? But that moment is eternal, of course, for Buber. But I think it is possible to have this encounter if we embed ourselves in the stories, in the histories, and the spaces that we have created together. When we meet face to face, immersed in the fluidity of our daily lives, that's when I think we are beginning to encounter the immigrant in full, with full dignity. In that sense, developing the language of peace entails a critique, and here I agree with Johnny entirely, a critique of the detached and sovereign Cartesian subject. I know postmodernists love to attack Descartes. There's nothing that postmodernists love more, you know, than to invoke Descartes every time they want to talk about some sort of evil that has happened in the world, right? But it is this detached and sovereign subject that is at the heart of Western modernity. And this detached self and subject is the source of our ideas of identity as unitary and exclusionary, right? As in when we talk about the relations between Latinos and African Americans. One can only be African American or Latino, right? And these are impermeable identities, only in competition with each other. This is what I call the billiard model of society. Right? These people are impermeable to each other, and they're in competition, again, with the whole idea of the scarcity. There is no sense here that identities can be fragmentary, that they can be fleeting, that they can be the result of transculturation, that there's a large element of the Latino community that is of African descent, for example, right? And also that there are African Americans who also have Latino ancestry, right? So that we have this cross-fertilized we, the more capacious we that Putnam is talking about. These kinds of Cartesian notions of identity that are reified is, I think, what we need to fight off. This is what Chuck talked about when he talked about the desire for purity, right? The reduced self. That's the Cartesian self, the reduced self. The self that has, in the process of finding foundations, right? As Descartes goes to cogito ergo sum, what is it that I can find that is foundational so that I can have full certainty and I can have this God's eye view of the world? What you do, you strip the self of everything. You strip the self of the body. You strip the self of history. You strip the self of relationships. And you end up with this reduced self that is a very impoverished self. And I want to say that that is the self that we continue to operate for the most part with. It's a generalized problem, not just with the issue of immigration, but I think it comes out there. The Cartesian self is also driven by the search for ultimate foundations, to have a God's eye view of the world from which he or she, in this case, is he. So I don't feel like I'm being sexist by using only the he, because that's what Descartes meant, where who can order the world. Of course, those not fitting into or resisting this universal order that this Cartesian self produces will have to be excluded. They will have to be disciplined. They will have to be segregated. They will have to be eliminated. So our task in creating the favorable conditions for the emergence of a language of peace will have to begin, I would argue, by a re-emplacing and a re-embodying of Western subjectivity. So that the experience of the self comes to experience itself as situated, as fragile, right? If I can invoke Heidegger here, that the self can understand itself as throne, as being there, as Dasein and as Mitsein, that is, as being there and being with, as dependent on other human beings and non-human beings, I would argue too, for its survival and fulfillment. This deep realization of being thrown in and among our shared life worlds is made more urgent by globalization. And here I bring my interest in globalization. By the rapid movement of goods, ideas, capital, people across national borders. We are at each other's backyards. And so religion, which has been produced, I think, and has entered translocal flows, let me see here, which has been produced, does it have the resources to imagine and construct transnational communities? And I think this goes back to Josh's point. This sentence doesn't make any sense, so I need to change it. Sometimes it's like that, you know, okay, the idea should be there. So can we use religion? Can we use religion, which is transnational from the get-go, which existed prior to the nation state? Can we use that to imagine and construct ourselves differently? This task is not easy when you ask this question. In my interview with Moyers, I talked about how U.S.-born Christians have a hard time reconciling Christianity's claim to universality, right? The reign of God gathers people from all nations of the world. And they have a hard time reconciling that, the claim to universality, with the secular imperative of upholding the laws of the nation. So I was told by some people, and this is consistent, quote by some Euro-Americans, inside the church, I must welcome the undocumented immigrant as my brother and sister in Christ. As someone who is revitalizing my congregation, gosh, they bring new energy to my congregation. Gosh, they're doing things so differently. This congregation was dying. And all of a sudden, you got these people coming in, and they really know how to rock the place. But once we cross that threshold of the church, I want the law to be applied to him, even if it means that he is deported. This is what I would say, the struggle, the citizenship, the dual citizenship, right? Yeah, the dual citizenship, universal and at the same time national, right? Arguably, no one has struggled more with this tension than the Catholic Church, which in America has been the immigrant church par excellence. On the one hand, the church defends the right to immigrate, to escape an oppressive condition, or even in search of a better life. Moreover, we heard Benedict XVI during his recent visit to the United States, basically advocating very strongly for the humane treatment of immigrants as part of his emphasis on the culture of life and the need to respect the dignity of the person. While Benedict did not explicitly argue for amnesty, he spoke very clearly about the need to protect the unity of immigrant families, not breaking them apart through rash deportations. So on the one hand, the church is very much an immigrant church, right? Sees this as a global church. But on the other hand, the church recognizes the legitimate right of nation states to safeguard borders and to implement their own policies regarding immigration. I would argue that in this situation, what we have is two positions that are at a very minimum in tension with each other. And I think this is symptomatic of the tensions that Christians are experiencing as a result of globalization. On the one hand, we have the demands of the nation state, which for the last 350 years, since the Peace of Westphalia in 1648, since then has been dominant, the dominant way in which we, as in the West, imagine ourselves as communities, to borrow a felicitous expression used by historian Benedict Anderson, that we come to imagine ourselves as nations. Nations did not exist. Nations are artifacts that were created. And it's been 350 years. So it's a sedimented way of imagining ourselves. And this idea of the nation as a democratic state elected by a people contained in a prescribed territory, sharing a core culture, which often included one language and one religion, has become so sedimented, so reified, that it is now taken to be as the only natural form of social organization. This is what I call epistemic nationalism. It's part of our episteme. Of course, how else can we order the world? It's got to be nation states. That's the only way in which we organize the world. But the world was not organized there like that 350 years ago. And perhaps if it is a historical construct, if it was a cultural construct, can we think beyond the nation state? And what would it mean to think beyond the nation state? Do we need to think beyond the nation state, or can we relativize it, just like modernity? Can the nation state be relativized? Can its ontological pretensions be lowered? And can we have a more humble idea of nationalism, which is, I think, what Chuck was trying to articulate here, right? So I would say that the current phase of globalization, with its furious dialectic of time and space compression, and here I'm quoting David Harvey, and also distanciation, so Anthony Giddens, has unsettled this epistemic nationalism, setting in motion new dynamics and intensifying old ones that include immigration, environmental degradation, and the deepening and widening of capitalism. The question for me is whether we have the moral resources, the moral intellectual resources, which we have developed in the last few centuries under the episteme of the national, to help us address problems and conflicts that are increasingly global in scale. Right? For the last 350 years, we've been operating with this dual notions of sovereignty. Sovereignty in self and sovereignty in nation. These go hand in hand. Right? Postmodernism has questioned sovereignty of self. Postcolonialism has begun to challenge sovereignty in nation. And I think this whole question of illegality is a good way for us to bring these two together. Okay. In developing the language of peace, through which we can address thorny transnational conflicts and problems like immigration or environmental degradation, do we need to challenge the notion of national sovereignty? Here I'm getting in trouble, right? Do we need to question notions of national sovereignty? Just as we need to critique the foundational idea of an encumbered, overly rational, and domineering self, do we not need to relativize the idea of nation, to see it as a useful but fallible construct, and to rethink this socio-cultural artifact in ways that re-embed us in the global, just as we need to re-embed and re-embody the Cartesian self? Maybe we need to re-embed the nation state and re-historicize it in the global process. I'm coming to an end here. Although religion has often been tightly connected with national identity, such as the notion of national destiny, right? It precedes epistemological nationalism. Religion doesn't have to be beholden to epistemological nationalism. Can religion then provide resources to rethink the nation? What kinds of social political formations do we need to build in order to encourage global languages of peace? Not one single national language of peace. Does the beloved community have to be coterminous with our nation? How far should we extend the limit of this community? How inclusive can and should it be? I use Dr. King's expression here because I think his unfulfilled vision of the beloved community as, quote, total relatedness, and his call for, quote, that his call for the fact that, quote, our loyalties need to transcend our race, our tribe, our class, and our nation. As King speaking, maybe that's pointing the way towards this. Still, I would say that these are very tough questions. I don't have an answer to this, right? But I just wanted to pose them for collective reflection. My humble contribution in this conversation about the language of peace is to suggest that we need to engage in an examination and critique of our taken-for-granted notions of sovereignty and autonomy as they apply both to self and society. To what extent do these notions we hold so dear and so natural to us lead to practices of domination and exclusion that contradict modernity's own claims to free humanity. You see, modernity claimed that it was going to free humanity. But in a certain sense, just like the Frankfurt School tells us, the dream becomes a nightmare, right? It becomes a myth. And in a certain sense, the myth comes to enslave us. I believe that this critical exploration is vital to providing to the task of learning the language of peace. Now, I realize this is a very abstract discussion, and I'm very happy to talk about local examples of communities that are trying to bridge this, that are trying to talk about this subject. But at least I wanted to sort of have some reflections about what this issue does for me at the level of the intellect. So, thank you very much.